Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Well, the Dow just had a great month. I don't know if anybody knows about it. I think we've been talking about it here on WGN, but I don't see many stories about it. To put it in perspective, the Dow had its best month since 8 years before I was born. And I know that I'm younger than some of the voices you may hear on this station, respectfully, but I'm not that young. This was a long time ago. Is this getting any press? How great of a month the Dow had? We'll talk about it with Craig Bolanos in just a bit. Also with someone, a financial advisor who actually has dealt with people who have won the lottery. So if you're going to win $1 billion tonight, make sure you're listening. We've got some advice for you and plenty more coming up on Your Money Matters. You know it better as Halloween, but nothing scary about what the Dow did this month, Craig Bolanos. Best month ever since 1976. I don't feel like people are talking about it. They're running scared still, Craig.
No, everybody's running scared. The ghosts and the goblins are out, and it's got investors super nervous to look up their 401k, look up their IRA balances. But the reality here is October has traditionally proven to be the bear market killer. This, in fact, just might be an example of that. It is too early to say we're out of the woods. We can get all technical, but at least it's a sigh of relief after that bear market trap that ushered in July and August of this year.
Yeah, Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. I was watching some of the stations this morning, and people were already prognosing, oh, well, perhaps now this is where the rally runs out of steam and goes back down and tests new bottom. I guess, you know, anything's possible, Craig. So I guess take today where we are, take a sigh of relief, maybe look at your 401k, peek at it ever so slightly. But, yeah, I mean, I guess we don't really know where we're going next.
No, we don't know where we're going next. And, John, what you and I can agree with, because we talk about this on your show all the time, is the long term always takes care of itself. And I think for investors who are looking out 12 to 15 months from now, this is still a great opportunity point, even after the rally in October. For everybody else, though, that's a short-term thinker, and parts of the portfolio probably can and do deserve to be short-term. Right now, we're stuck in a range. There's a massive level of support at 3,700 in the S&P, a big wall of resistance at 4,200 in the S&P, but this is a great opportunity for everyone who's investing to take stock of what they own and make some changes if it supports their long-term plan and gets them into a sleep at night portfolio.
I think there had been some murmurs that perhaps the Fed would slow down, but I think everyone's kind of come to the consensus that this week is going to be another 3/4 of a basis point hike. Market already baked that one in a while ago, didn't it?
Oh, it most certainly did. You know, now it's going to be newsworthy to have yet another 75 basis points or 3/4 point hike. But these things are already baked into the bond market. They are certainly baked into the recipe that is the stock market. What everyone's really going to be taking cues and looking for is the language that comes out. At what point in time does the Fed pivot? But if you're asking for an opinion, you didn't ask this, I'm going to give it. I want them to go ahead and give us the 75 tomorrow. The Fed needs to continue to restore faith and confidence in them as an institution, and that means follow through, and that's exactly what we plan on them doing.
And we'll wait like 30 minutes until we start prognosing what comes in December. I do want to note that we're going to get a report on Friday, the jobs report. I feel like every week we're expecting the weekly jobless numbers to go up, and you'll see a little spikes here and there, but generally still historically low. But the monthly number coming down a little bit is still fine, right? Still adding jobs. That's a good thing. But this is I don't want to put too much emphasis on it, but it's another report to look at this week on Friday.
No, I think, listen, everyone pays attention to the inflation data month over month. Everyone can and should pay attention to the jobs data month over month. And it's amazing that it's been so resilient thus far. And I have to think that part of what the Fed has been wanting to do, part of this plan of continuing to raise interest rates, raising the cost of borrowing, is to slow down the consumer. And as this consumer slows down, we're finally going to see it reflected in some of the jobs numbers. But if we raise the unemployment rate from 3.5%, which is still an all-time record low, and we tick it up a couple of notches, it's disappointing for those who will be misplaced, but it's just usual and routine economics. And I think the Fed is just trying to make sure we don't have a wage price spiral. So seeing some softness finally come into the jobs market would actually be an example of bad news being good news for equities, John.
Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Have the trick-or-treaters already made it through your part of town?
Well, you've already heard the doorbell ring not twice but thrice while we've been on the phone. I've had to mute that thing. I told my wife, Leslie, my best friend, I'm like, you stand outside and give away candy because I'm with John at WGN. We can't have the doorbell ring.
I appreciate that dedication. Invest with WMG.com. Craig, we'll do it again soon, okay?
Sounds great, my friend.
Greg McBride joins us. He's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate. We're going to be talking about some scary financial situations. Clever, Greg, on this Halloween.
Happy Halloween, John. Great to be with you.
Well, this is the season, not necessarily Halloween, but looking forward to the big spending that comes with the holidays. And things can get a little scary here in Q4 for the average consumer.
Yeah, certainly. As if inflation hasn't stretched the household budget far enough, there's just a temptation to spend for holiday expenses, whether it's travel, gift giving, meals, you name it. The tendency to bust the budget, to add to the debt, to run down the savings, is certainly there. And I think this year, perhaps more than others, I think it's particularly prudent to be really vigilant on those fronts. Credit card rates are at a 30-year high. That emergency fund, you want to save that for real emergencies. Holiday shopping is not one of them, especially if with all the forecasts of a recession next year. You want to have more savings, not less savings. Definitely steer clear of dipping into that during this holiday shopping season.
Yeah, let's start there with credit card debt. It's never a good thing, but people dip into it and end up leaving a balance because of gifts, food, decoration, and other items. I know it's easy just to say, don't do it, don't get into debt, but people seem to feel this pressure. Do you think it's a matter of really, really setting that budget and sticking with it?
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, holiday season comes the same time every year. I mean, it shouldn't sneak up on you. Plan ahead. You save a consistent amount every paycheck or every month all year long so that the money's there when you need it. If you do find yourself in a situation where come early January, the credit card statements start to come in, you went a little bit overboard, you develop a game plan on getting it paid back. And in particular, if you've got good credit, there's a lot of those 0% offers that are still out there for balance transfers, even for purchases. If you have to make a big ticket purchase, it's going to take you a while to pay off. Consider getting one of those cards that offers an introductory rate of 0%. Some of those, John, last as long as 21 months. So you can give yourself a great runway to get that debt paid off without having to face interest charges and doing so at a time when interest rates are on the rise.
Yeah, I've used that 0% trick once. Well, it's not a trick. I used it once with an introductory rate. It helped so much for a big purchase I just absolutely had to make. I literally put the balance on that was on it. I did the little math. I divided it by, I did one less month just in case I messed up. I did it by 20, I think, instead of 21. Set it and forget it. And that really helped.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit on a key point is, sort of mapping out the plan in terms of, subtracting that 1 month just so you don't miss it, just so you don't mess up. You still give yourself plenty of time and then automate that as much as possible. Setting the reminders of when the statement cycle ends, when the payment due date is, whether it's setting a reminder in your calendar, signing up for email alerts from the card issuer when your statement is ready, just those triggers so that you don't forget, so that you don't miss a payment. you know, nothing worse than missing a payment on a 0% interest and then subjecting yourself to a potential penalty rate down the road or something.
Sure. Let's talk about missing that credit card payment, not necessarily on 0%, but others. Things happen, right? I think a lot of people, you know, maybe they don't automate it yet, or some people pay it off more often, but then if they forget for a couple of weeks, they just realize they missed that payment date. Is it immediately time to hit the panic button?
Well, not the panic button, but hit the payment button. You know, I'd make that payment as quick as you can. And if this is a one-time slip-up, call the issuer and say, you know, see if you can get any late fee that may have applied. See if you can get that waived. But if you just go ahead, make the payment quickly. You limit any damage to your credit. Card issuers aren't going to report you to the credit bureaus as being delinquent until you're at least 30 days delinquent. And oftentimes it's longer than that. So if it's one of those where it's a couple weeks later and you realize you missed your payment, just go ahead, make the payment. Even if it's just the minimum payment, you can always come back later and make more of a payment. And then contact the issuer, see if you can get that fee waived. Point is, you know, one-time slip up, you've got some latitude to get that fee waived. If you're regularly making late payments, your card issuer is not going to work with you on that.
Greg McBride from Bankrate.com. You mentioned the emergency fund. Boy, oh boy, holiday gifts are not an emergency. And when we say an emergency fund, I think we try and say stick with it at all costs.
It's for needs, not wants. And, most Americans, I think, are in a fairly precarious position with regard to having an adequate emergency fund. Only about one in four households actually has what we would term an adequate emergency fund, enough to cover 6 months worth of expenses. Only 40% of households could cover an unplanned $1,000 expense out of savings. So most people, they need more savings, not less savings. And so really holding a firm line on what constitutes an emergency, when you're going to dip into that, I think is really, really important. Not only do you need to be feeding that account regularly, ideally through direct deposit of through every pay period, having a direct deposit into that savings account. But then you got to treat it as deposit only. Don't be making withdrawals and kind of putting yourself on a treadmill to nowhere. That balance will build up over time with regular deposits, but you've got to keep your hands off it in the meantime.
For sure. Greg McBride, Bankrate.com. Thank you so much for joining us, okay?
Thank you, John.
Always appreciate it. Let's take a break. I do have a question of the day. Maybe we'll be able to get one answer in. It's a carryover from last week. Oh, boy, we're going for a little while here. Here it is. New York has 192 of these. That's the most in the country. Chicago is second at 180, and Las Vegas is third at 169. What am I talking about? 312-981-7200. Hopefully we'll get an answer before the end of the show today on WGN. 720 WGN. It's Your Money Matters. It's 640. I'm John Hansen. We're going to find out what a mortgage buy-down is in just one moment. Hopefully we can get an answer to the question of the day. I have it memorized at this point already, and I don't even have to look at my sheet. New York has the most in the country at 192. Chicago second at 180. And Las Vegas third at 179, I believe. Let's go to Dawn. Dawn, what's your guess?
Limousines for hire.
No, that's a good guess, though, especially that Vegas one. I could see where you were thinking. Robert, what is your guess? Robert, going once, going twice. Robert was listening to the radio, and he is gone, unfortunately. Holden Lewis is here, though. He is the mortgage and home expert at NerdWallet. And Holden, thanks for hopping on the line with us.
Good evening.
I've never heard of a mortgage buy down, and I guess that makes sense because they haven't been very popular for a long time, have they?
No, you know, this shows that you're a young person, right? I decided to write this article about temporary buy downs because I know that people bought and sold houses in the early 1980s, even when mortgage rates were like 18%.
Right.
So I started calling around asking old timers. Had you guys sell houses? And buy downs was one of the tactics that people used.
Can you explain it to us in simple terms? I mean, it's not too hard to understand, but just explain it to everybody.
It's a little complex. So a temporary buy down is when the seller pays part of the buyer's mortgage payment for a year or two. And it works like this. Let's say you get a mortgage at 7% interest rate. If you get a one-year buy-down, then your payments would be based on a 6% rate in the first year, and then it would go up to your regular rate after that. And it's the seller or the home builder who is paying that difference.
Okay, so the seller is essentially kind of putting some of that money away, I imagine, like an escrow, into an account that is going to take this money and take it and send it to the lender. So the seller is forking over some of their selling costs, I guess you could say, or some eating into their profit, but they get to still say they sold it for full price or for a full amount.
That's right. You know, if they care about what the neighbors think, you know, they might not cut that last $5,000 from the price, but they can turn around and, you know, furnish like $5,000 worth of an incentive there through the buy down.
I imagine this is really advantageous, obviously, with these mortgage rates going up, but especially for first time home buyers who realize that they're going to have, as I've just realized in the last couple of weeks, how much extra money you have to spend at a house that maybe you didn't think of before. And just it could just be that one thing, that one extra little nudge you need to take the step into the pool.
That's right. Let's say you get a $300,000 mortgage. Well, a one-year buy-down could save you about $200 a month in the first year. So that's $200 that you can put aside to buy furniture, buy appliances, or, you know, rebuild that savings account that you depleted when you put down the down payment and paid your closing costs.
How is this different than an ARM, an ARM?
It's different from an ARM because with a buy down, your interest rate never changes. What's different is just who pays the interest. You know, with a temporary buy down, the home seller pays part of your interest for the first year or maybe the first 2 or 3 years. But with an ARM, it's you, the buyer, who's paying all the interest. It's just that you have that initial like 5 years of a lower rate, and then it can change every 6 months after that.
So in the early 80s, this was a popular way to be able to sell homes. Are we seeing it making a resurgence? Have you heard from people who have actually kind of gone through one of these deals?
We are seeing it make a resurgence. I haven't talked to anyone who's actually done one of the deals, but there's a few banks out there that are actually, the bank is paying for a one-year buy-down instead of, you know, depending on the home seller to do it. And, you know, these lenders are just, they're doing this to, well, to be competitive.
Now that the scripts have kind of flipped and in some cases the buyers have a little bit more power, even though they're paying a lot more in interest rates, should this be something that people have in their back pocket and potentially use as a negotiation tool if they think it works for them?
It's definitely a good idea, whether you're a buyer or a seller. If you're selling a house, you know, offering a temporary buy down is probably a really good way to compete with the other sellers. And if you're a buyer, if you're looking for, you know, concessions on part of the seller, this might be a good way to do it.
All right. Holden Lewis, mortgage and home expert at NerdWallet. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's a buy down. All right. All right. We're going to find out what to do if you win the lottery in one moment. First, hopefully an answer to the question of the day. New York has the most at 192. Chicago second. Las Vegas third. What am I talking about? Fran, you're on WGN. Fran, what's your guess?
Firehouses?
Firehouses. Great guess, just not the answer. Robert, are you there, my friend?
Can you hear me, John?
I can hear you now. What's your guess, my friend?
Oh, very good. I was interrupted by some trick-or-treaters.
Ah, yes, yes.
Hey, John, before I give you my answer, my son's a firefighter, as well as your family members are firefighters.
That's right. Both my brothers and my dad just retired as a fire chief. Good memory there, Robert. And
I love your shows, John.
Thank you.
Your shows.
All right, so go ahead. What's your guess?
My answer is bridges.
That's a great guess. It's just not the answer, Robert. I'm sorry. Have a great night, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for playing. All right. I hope you're playing the lottery tonight, only because it's just so fun to dream. I know we're not going to win. I know I'm not going to win. Iridian thinks she's going to win, but I don't know if she's going to win. Andrea Williams is a wealth advisor at Northwestern Mutual. And Andrea, if you are the lucky winner, you or anyone else listening, boy, you better have someone smart like yourself behind to help you on out. Thanks for joining us today, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
It must be a life-changing thing, obviously. And I know you've dealt with people that may have won a lottery, I don't know, about $1 billion, but what are those first moments like? What do you advise for people to do the moment they look at their ticket and they realize they've won the big jackpot?
Well, my recommendations would begin with taking a few deep breaths and remaining calm.
Okay.
You want to make sure you're in a good state of mind to make rational decisions. The second thing that I would recommend doing is actually making a copy of your ticket. You want to make sure that you have it in a secure place. And I'd also recommend trying to stay anonymous for as long as possible,
mm-hmm.
because you just never know who can come out of the woodwork if too many people find out that you're the winner.
Right. I would be so worried about that ticket. I can never find my wallet or my car keys when I'm leaving the house, let alone keeping that ticket secure. But I guess you mentioned a key thing there. I think a lot of people, maybe the thought would be, I'm not showing up to work tomorrow. You have a little time to get this sort of stuff lined up. And do you want to have things lined up financially before you go through with all the entire process of coming forward and collecting the money, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely. I would recommend beginning to assemble your team of professionals to create a plan, doing that as quickly as possible. And after you come forward and start to obtain some of the resources that you've won, you'll want to have a plan in place before you start to receive those resources, because there are a lot of things that you'll need to anticipate, like paying taxes. A lot of times people think that they're going to get the entire, you know, $800 million, but in reality, taxes take a good portion of it. And taxes are the single largest expense we'll ever experience. You know, while we're working, while we're not working. So that's something we definitely have to be conscious of. And we want to make sure we can dial down to what the dollar amount truly is that we will have in our hand that we can begin to work with after we've won the lottery.
I wouldn't even know where to begin, but that's a great point. Andrea Williams joining us, a wealth advisor at Northwestern Mutual. Okay, so annuity or lump sum payment? I'm always of the belief, get the lump sum, but are there circumstances where the annuity, the annual payment, is better?
I get that question a lot. I would say if you don't feel like you have a lot of self-control or you don't have a strong team behind you, that is where the annuity can make more sense, because that prefix in that word it means annual. They're going to give you an annual income either for a set period of time or for the rest of your life, for as long as you live. But if you feel that you can manage the money well, if you feel that you've assembled a team and you can make good decisions, that is where the lump sum can make more sense. It's difficult when you choose the annuity if you decide that you need a lot more money than what that annual income is going to be, if you want to make an investment or do something significant with those dollars. Once you've chosen the annuity, you can't go back. You can't go back and get that larger lump sum. So you really want to work with a financial professional to identify which route makes the most sense for you.
All right. What is okay to buy? And what should you maybe stay away from buying, at least at first?
I think it's totally fine to buy some fun toys, and to purchase a vehicle. You don't want to restrain yourself for too long, but I typically encourage people to purchase things that can appreciate, that are somewhat of an investment, but they are also things that you can enjoy. Sometimes fine jewelry or watches, homes, those are all things that appreciate. We have to be conscious of purchasing things that depreciate, like vehicles. Those are going to have a backwards motion, whereas purchasing a home or any other real estate or precious metals, jewelry, those things are going to have a forward motion and appreciate with you as time goes on.
We hear so many people going broke. I imagine a lot of that is from buying a bunch of depreciating things or taking on a lot of debt that they don't need, and maybe that money doesn't stretch as far as they can. You mentioned assembling a team. I imagine that is, as like you said, so important to not running out of money. Who's on the team? I imagine someone like you, a financial planner, but what, like a lawyer too? Life coach? Who do you want on the team?
Absolutely. I don't think that's a bad idea. Having a life coach on the team, that is someone who can help you get really clear with your goals. Your financial planner also helps you get really clear with your financial goals. Having an accountant to make sure that you're accounting for all of the tax that you will have to pay. It's often that you'll have to pay federal income tax. There's state taxes you may have to pay. There can be county taxes. So you want to make sure you get really well versed on what all that entails. And then involving an estate planning attorney, because once you're over certain limits in net worth, you will be subject to estate taxes. If you pass and you pass on your assets to the next generation in your family, working with an attorney will help you get everything mapped out so that when you do pass, the assets go to whom they're supposed to go to, as opposed to ending up in probate or going to the state. And then the state has to hire attorneys to figure out who your resources should go to, who rightfully has a stake in your resources. And that can be very costly. And that's why estate taxes at the federal level are as large as 40%. And that's because they really want to incentivize us to get up, go out and hire the team so that we can decide where our resources go, not default and have the state decide where our resources go.
Absolutely. Andrea Williams, you'll be my first call tomorrow, okay? Wealth advisor at Northwestern Mutual.
Fantastic.
Yeah, northwesternmutual.com. Hope we chat again soon, okay?
Thank you.